Hello and welcome to Root Causes, the PKI and Security podcast, where a couple of industry old hands talk about all matters PKI and digital certificates. I am Tim Callen, Senior Fellow at Sectigo, and I am joined by Jason Sirocco, CTO of IoT at Sectigo. How are you doing today, Jay?
Doing fantastic, Tim. Thank you.
And we are lucky enough to have a guest today. We have our returning guest, Alan Grau. Alan is VP of IoT and Embedded Solutions here at Sectigo. Alan's been with us before, and welcome back, Alan.
Thanks, Tim. Great to be here.
So, gentlemen, today, I think what we are talking about, we want to get into a little more detail about botnets. We talk about botnets a lot on this program and, you know, in our lives, and everybody sort of talks about what they are. But the idea today was we would really get into what are they, how do they work, what really happens with botnets, and this can include both, you know, good old-fashioned, you know, computers owned machines, but also how has the world of botnets changed as we've moved into the world of IoT. So it's a lot of meaty stuff, but let's see what we can get through on this podcast. Does that sound good?
Yeah, thanks, Tim. I think where we might be able to start before we bring Alan in, whenever we talk about IoT botnets, quite often the term the Mirai botnet comes up. And that's for good reason. It's because that was one of the original very large botnets that took advantage of static identifier, static credentials, where the guys who wrote the code really didn't have to work very hard to actually crack these machines. Alan will get into this in a lot deeper way. I think one of the interesting things that happened with the Mirai botnet is that the source code for it became public. And if any of you listening remember what happened when the Zeus virus source code became actually available to just anybody, all of a sudden people didn't have to reinvent the wheel and they were able to make a lot of variations. So the Mirai botnet is still alive and well out there, just in different forms. In fact, thousands and thousands of different forms. It's a really big deal. And I think the flip side to this, before we bring on, you know, the meaty part of this topic, the big takeaway that I would like everybody to get here is for anybody in the business of device manufacturing for IoT, obviously one of the big things you're worried about is privacy and fraud. And you're worried about, you know, information that the device itself might be working with getting into the hands of somebody it shouldn't be. The problem with these botnets is it's a counterintuitive kind of concept where the device that you're manufacturing is all of a sudden being compromised in such a way where it's being used for things that you just never imagined, whether it's for a DDoS attack or for ransomware or for things that... Goodness, you never intended for that device to do those kinds of things. And so therefore, you need to be aware of this. And I think for everybody, even if you're not an IoT device manufacturer, if you're a consumer of these devices, it is something you need to keep your eyes on. And Alan, how does this all work?
Yeah, Jason. So before I get into the how it works, I think there's a couple of interesting statistics that are worth sharing. And, you know, because people have asked me, it's like, okay, yeah, I'm building an IoT device, but is anybody going to really bother to create attacks that target my device? Do I really need to be worried about security for it? Right? I'm building a connected refrigerator. I'm building a, you know, a smart home device that's going to sit inside the home and, you know, monitor some activity in the home. It's not really a high profile target that's got a lot of sensitive data. And are people really going to attack that? And with botnets, the attacks are all automated. So the attacks aren't seeking out targets based solely upon, you know, being able to steal credit card information off of them or medical records off of them or things like that. It's just an automated attack that's out sweeping a broad range of, you know, IP addresses or other addresses to find devices.
Right. Well, and the value is different, right, Alan? I mean, if I'm trying to steal information, then what matters is the information that's on the device. But if I'm trying to run a bot, what's really matters is available processing power.
Exactly. Yeah. So there was an interesting report that came out from the Nokia Threat Labs. They do their annual threat intelligence report, I think is the title of it. But there's a report they put out. And so this is looking specifically at traffic and attacks occurring on the Nokia network. But it's, you know, Nokia's operates a very large network. So it gives a very good view into trends globally. And so I think we can look at that data as being reasonably representative. If you're on a different network, the numbers might vary slightly. But
sure.
Their 2018 report, they looked at the malware traffic on their network. And of all the malware traffic on their network, 78% of the malware traffic was from IoT botnets.
Okay.
Yeah, okay. That's wow. Staggering.
Yeah.
35%, so almost half of it, or almost half of the IoT botnet traffic was from variants of Mirai alone, which gets back to Jason's point that, yeah. You know, the source code's out there. Somebody can take that, modify it without great technical expertise and launch a new attack. And they actually found that, and this is one I found a little bit interesting, that of the infected devices on their network, because they were able to trace back to where the traffic was coming from, 16% of the infected devices were IoT devices, which surprised me a little bit because those 16% are producing 78% of the traffic. So people really are utilizing IoT devices very heavily in IoT device attacks or IoT right. botnet attacks.
And this also makes sense, right? Because one of the things about your IoT device is that much of the time it's probably inert, right? It's probably not. If I have a sensor and it's supposed to alert me when something happens, most of the time that something isn't happening. Or if I have a sensor that's supposed to send me a regular update of here are my numbers, how big are numbers and how long does that take? So you tend to have a lot of dead time, a lot of dead compute time, and also a lot of dead bandwidth. And so that leaves a lot to be grabbed and used by something like a botnet.
That's true. And in addition to that, most IoT devices are what I would call, we refer to as headless devices, meaning they don't have a monitor and keyboard. So you don't, you know, if something is running on my laptop and starts to grab tremendous amounts of processing time or network bandwidth, I'm going to notice that during my interaction with the device.
Right.
So that's another factor. So some of the other things that they found is if you install a new IoT device on their network, it's going to be targeted for an attack and be being attacked within minutes, probably less than a minute.
Okay.
So, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Just a couple of other statistics, and these weren't all from the same report. Some of them came from some other reports. I think one of the reports was F5 does an annual security report. But according to that, they said that over half of IoT devices with a web interface have a known HTTP vulnerability. So, you know, if it's your home router or if it's a smart refrigerator that has a web interface that allows you to go in and set the Wi-Fi password, over half of those, 51.2% was the number they gave, had a known vulnerability on the HTTP protocol. So that's huge. And then the last one, this one surprised me as well. There's as part of the F5, and again, I believe it was the F5 security report, it may have been something different. They actually have created a number of IoT honeypots that they've scattered around the world and monitor for attacks. And with their set of honeypots, they saw almost 800 million attacks in 2017, a little over a billion in 2018. So, you know, a 20% or so increase. In the first half of 2019, they hit almost 3 billion attacks.
Okay.
So the attacks are clearly on the rise.
Right.
So, yeah.
So yeah, a 200% increase, like even if you stopped the calendar right there, it'd be a 200% increase, or even if it just maintained at that pace and didn't continue to accelerate over the course of the year, that would be a 500% increase.
Actually, it's almost a 300% increase. So it goes from 1 billion to almost 3 billion. So
right. In the first half of the year.
In the first half,
which would pace to 6 billion over the course of the year, even if it didn't keep accelerating. So that's massive. Yeah.
Yes. So, and the point of that, and the reason I bring this up is, the threat isn't just real, it's prevalent, it's consistent, and it really is staggering the amount of traffic, the amount of devices that are affected, you know, the impact of these attacks. We were talking just before we got on the started recording about how do these happen, right? I've had people ask me, it's like, okay, so there have been reports of a home, and I mentioned the home refrigerator again because that's an actual publicized attack. How does that happen? And some of it starts back with what Jason said. There are repositories of code publicly, widely available on the internet that have either fully created botnet source code, or even if not that, automated attack tools that can be used and wrapped into botnets. So if I want to go out and create a botnet, I don't have to go out and start from scratch creating new attacks, right? There's all sorts of tools, some used by white hat hackers and security professionals in doing security assessments and penetration testing, some used for much more nefarious purposes, but there's a large repository of existing attacks that I can just take, build into my solution and utilize.
Right. So this is now in the script kiddie realm of attack. And so we saw the same thing with phishing, right? Which is originally you had to sit and create your own things. And so you had to be at least somewhat sophisticated. And pretty soon it got to the point where all these things were just packaged up and you could just go get them. And, you know, anybody with a basic level of computer knowledge could go and run these attacks. Now the same thing is happening, right? Anybody with a basic level of computer knowledge can go and try to build their own botnet. Is that correct, Alan?
Yep, that's exactly the case. And so, yeah, so that's exactly what people are doing. And the way the botnets work, and this again was kind of the question that came up for me in a discussion with somebody a few weeks ago, is, you know, if you break it down, you know, the blocking and tackling of how a botnet works. And you know, most botnets are actually technically computer worms, or a botnet is composed of a set of computers that have been infected by the code, which is in itself a computer worm. So
right.
If we step back, right, a botnet is a collection of bots, and each bot is an infected computer or an infected IoT device. And so if I've created, right, I sit down, I download one of the botnets, the source code from one of the botnets off the web someplace, make some modifications to it.
Yeah.
I then have to find a way to get that out in the wild. And so, you know, people will take it and run it on some server that's in, you know, behind some obfuscated IP address. So it's not easy to find the original location of the server. And it then starts, the software has scanning mechanisms built in where it will go out and look for IP addresses. And as it finds IP addresses, it will then run this set of known attacks against the device.
Yeah.
And it just continues to do that over and over. And there's usually some intelligence built in. Usually these attacks have some ability to look at the traffic and how the device responds to some basic messages and can identify that, oh, this may look like a Windows device. It may look like a Linux device. It may look like a specific brand of home router or specific manufacturer's home router. And then it can say, well, I know that this home router
right.
is likely to have this default password or have this web vulnerability.
Yeah, or if it's unpatched, I can try this attack successfully, so I'll try it and see what happens.
Exactly. Yes.
Right.
And so, guys, one of the things that I've seen recently, right, is we've now had legislation proposed. We've actually had it passed in California. We've had it proposed at the U.S. federal level. UK federal legislation, I think Oregon as a state has proposed legislation for IoT devices, and most of it is in direct response to exactly what you've been talking about, Alan.
Yeah.
But I just for those that you know listening to this podcast, keep in mind that legislation is only most of the time worded very specifically to make sure that devices have a mechanism to be able to actually change the username and password or change the credential mechanism. And so therefore, it only goes maybe 1/10 of the way to how these things are actually working. Because as right. Alan just said, this worm is able to seek out devices that have specific vulnerabilities. Some of these vulnerabilities are not just static credentials. Additionally, almost none of the legislation is actually calling for things such as data encryption in transit. So therefore, even if you had a static identifier which had a mechanism for change, that identifier, that credential is actually going to be passed in the clear. That's something else that these tools are going to be able to catch.
So what good does that do you?
Well, so
I can change my password. And by the way, here's what it is.
Yeah. So if you look at it, right, I mean, it's surgical triage, right? Okay, this guy's got a gunshot wound to the abdomen. So let's deal with that. But unfortunately, you know, the guy's also been stabbed 3 times and, you know, has got an ear lopped off and the legislation doesn't deal with those issues, which you know, aren't the big gaping security hole that default static passwords are, and clearly needs to be addressed. So it's definitely a step in the right direction. It solves the huge gaping security hole. And some of these botnets rely only on that gaping security hole. So it would have stopped those botnets. But yeah, clearly they don't go far enough because there are other significant issues beneath that that need to be addressed.
Well, and isn't there another problem here that why am I motivated to change my password as the owner of one of these devices? Let's go back to your refrigerator example. I go, well, how much harm is really going to come to me? Let's say some bad actor did do something to my refrigerator. What are they really going to do? Melt my ice cream? So I, as an owner, am not particularly motivated to figure out how to change the password on that device. It's not like you get your refrigerator, look at it and say, oh, that's a gaping security flaw. I got to deal with that. So even if there's the ability for the end consumer to change the password, in that scenario, I'm going to ask the question, do they?
So some of the legislation actually requires that devices have to have their default password changed in order to enable internet connectivity.
Okay.
So to address that problem, because you're right, turns out I probably would change the password, but I'm kind of paranoid when it comes to cyber attacks. But my mom's not going to.
Right.
I might change hers for her, but you know, that's a very real consideration is, you know, how do we build devices that are easy for the average non-tech savvy consumer to use and still have high levels of security? And so, you know, that's a very, very real question. I think that there are other attacks that we're going to start to see against these types of devices. You know, I think we'll see ransomware attacks against IoT devices, and that's an interesting topic we should probably talk about at some point, that will affect the owner of the device. But we haven't seen that, at least not at scale today. Yeah. So I think that will evolve over time. But yeah, at this point, you know, people can, you know, now they've got their malware installed, right? Their worm, they've installed it on their server. It's gone out and it's found a couple of IoT devices to attack. And then it starts to propagate from there so they can move towards doing, you know, doing its nefarious things. And there are multiple things that can happen on the back end. But this gets to the question of, you know, how do they spread? So once an IoT device is infected, usually the first thing it does is it starts to take over a role in creating the attack. So it starts scanning the internet or scanning the network it's connected to, looking for other devices to attack, and that attack right. replicates. So you go from two devices infected to 4 to 8 to 16. The Mirai botnet, I think at one point they said it was doubling the number of infected nodes every 72 minutes.
Jeez.
So, which is how we got to, you know, 78% of the malware traffic,
yeah,
you know, was from IoT botnets, right? So they propagate and they can be smart about it, right? So if you've got four devices scanning, they each have a fourth of the computing or the address space to scan. Mm-hmm. But when you've got thousands of them, they each have a much smaller space to scan. And they do that by the devices that are infected. The malware will connect back and communicate with what's called a command and control center, which is, you know, a server someplace out in the internet that tells them what to do. You know, go scan this range of IP addresses for other devices that we can infect. And then at some point, when the botnet has spread widely enough, the command and control server will change the behavior of each of the bots. It will say, well, forget about scanning.
Right.
Let's go start our attack. And that could be, you know, exfiltrating data to see if there's any interesting data on the device. Much less of an issue with IoT devices. You know, your connected device in the home, if it's a set-top box, maybe it's got a credit card number that you're using to pay for movies on demand. So there's a potential for something like that. But again, home device is much less of an issue. Usually it's things like, well, let's go mine some cryptocurrency.
Yeah.
Or let's start a denial of service attack against a set of devices. And so the command and control center or command and control server is what instructs the malware to change its behavior from propagating to creating an attack against a specific target or doing whatever other activity it is that was intended by the botnet owner.
Yeah, and we actually just recently podcasted about a law enforcement action that took down an $850,000, 50,000 unit botnet by virtue of the fact that they managed to take away the command and control centers. And right. At that point, yeah, you can't do anything with those owned machines anymore.
Right, exactly. So you've taken away its ability to act intelligently in concert. So yeah, that's a very big action. You know, but one point I wanted to make, and it gets back to the point that Jason was making earlier about the legislation, saying that, you know, we need to be able to we need to enforce users changing default passwords. Well, if that's not enough, then how do we solve this problem, right? How do we ensure that our devices are truly secure? And that gets back to the heart of a lot of what, you know, you guys talk about on this podcast on a regular basis is, you know, utilizing certificates and PKI for enabling strong identity, enabling secure communication, enabling mutual authentication. You know, that's not the entire solution, but when we talk about replacing static credentials, that's really the step that needs to be taken to ensure that devices are secure, at least from the point of view of authentication and identity. There's other issues, other attacks like the HTTP vulnerabilities, other right. attacks that would come in that need to be addressed. But sure. you know, that's really a huge step forward that you know, the device manufacturers in some cases are starting to take much more seriously and starting to put it into place.
Yeah, it's one of these necessary but not sufficient situations, right? Like, there are other things beyond identity that can still be vulnerabilities, but if you don't have strong identity, then you aren't secure, period.
So we're on a PKI podcast, right? And I think maybe the way to finish off this particular discussion is we're talking about IoT devices that are, as Alan says, they're computers. And the difference with them is they typically don't have a human being sitting behind a screen and a keyboard that's controlling them. They're quite often doing their own thing. And I like to call those things headless devices. Mm-hmm. And the point to a headless device is, think about how often we've been told that using your password is a weak form of authentication. That's been known now in enterprise IT for years and years. And yet industry persists in using this form of authentication for IoT devices, even when it's the least applicable type of thing. You know, we're asking questions, is this a usability issue? Is my mom going to change the username and password? My question is, why are we still even doing that?
Sure.
And so, Alan, I think you spend a lot of your day talking to manufacturers of these kinds of devices. I would think that a user certificate, right, an X509 that's been provisioned onto this device for the purposes of authentication is a far stronger way of actually using a headless device in and giving it a strong form of authentication. Would you agree with that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And that's definitely something that we recommend. And again, what I am seeing is, you know, the dialogue is shifting with manufacturers, and they're starting to recognize that this is not just a theoretical, you know, academic issue, but a real burning issue in the field with their devices. And so they are starting to recognize that. It's just we have a long ways to go still.
We do have a long ways to go still, but we don't have a long ways to go in this podcast. So this maybe is a good place to wrap it up. I think that's a wonderful overview of the topic. Any last thoughts, Alan?
No, I think we've really done a decent job of covering the topic. I mean, I think the one last thought I would have is, you know, that this isn't an intractable problem, right? Device manufacturers can build devices with high levels of security if they really are proactive about it. So yeah. It is something that can be addressed and can be solved.
And they need motivation, right? And that's maybe another good topic for us to hit as well, is how do we make sure that the motivation is there for them to do that? Because if they're not economically rewarded to do this security, they won't. And if they are, they will. It's capitalism. So I think we should return to the topic of ransomware botnets. I think that's very interesting. And maybe also the topic of how do you build a system that would motivate manufacturers to do these things. So good things to look forward in the future. Alan Grau, VP of IoT and Embedded Systems, thank you very much for joining us today. And of course, Tim. Jason, as always, pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you, Alan.
And thanks, guys. This has been Root Causes.